It's a pleasure today to have Zachweller Davis as our speaker in the Quantum Foundation seminar, and he will talk about decoherence versus space-time diffusion, testing the quantum nature of gravity.
So thank you, Flaminia, for the introduction, and thanks everyone for coming and for giving me the opportunity to speak. I'm going to talk about some of the work that we've been doing at UCL. So generally, we've been looking a lot at coupling classical and quantum systems, and in particular, trying to understand what we can learn in the context of gravitational physics, which is what I'm going to talk about today. So the work I'll talk about today is done in collaboration with these lovely people. So Jonathan Oppenheim, Joanne Camps, Carlos Baracciari, and Barbara Soder, who's here today. And it's the work is largely contained in these two papers, which were meant to appear a very long time ago and will very shortly appear. We found some interesting things that we wanted to explore, but everything should be out very soon. Okay, so I guess the motivation, so why are we interested in studying classical quantum dynamics, and what do I mean by classical quantum dynamics? So I guess that the general idea is that we want to study the regime in which you treat some degrees of freedom to be classical and some degrees of freedom to be quantum, and look at when the quantum system has some back reaction on the classical system. So the motivation is sort of twofold, and I should say up front that I'm agnostic as to which motivation is sort of the correct motivation, but I think there's interesting things to be learned nonetheless. So first of all, we're interested in revisiting the question of whether or not gravity can be fundamentally classical. So there's various literature, a lot of literature dating all the way back to Feynman in 1957, and later on in the 70s with Epley-Hanna famously, as to why the gravitational field should be quantized. And most of the arguments essentially are no-go arguments about coupling classical and quantum systems generally. So they pretty much assume a deterministic coupling between the classical degrees of freedom and the quantum degrees of freedom, and then use this to argue that you can't have a consistent consistent dynamics. But it's been known now since the work of Blanchard and Jacek in the 90s and also of Diossi that you can have a consistent coupling between the classical and quantum degrees of freedom, so long as you allow for the coupling to be stochastic. And what this means is essentially that the dynamics doesn't look like a, you know, Hamiltonian dynamics, but instead looks like a type of Lindbladian dynamics, for those of you familiar with open quantum systems. And we've been interested in asking the question of whether we can use this formalism to understand some of the consequences of treating the gravitational field classically. And secondly, I guess, if you believe instead that gravity should be quantum, then, you know, there should be a regime in which you can treat the gravitational field as if it, as though it behaves classically. So you could imagine picking your favorite theory of quantum gravity and then taking the limit in which the matter still behaves quantum, but the gravitational field behaves classically. And then you have some effective dynamics, which should be described by some classical quantum dynamics. And so, you know, the motivation is twofold, and we're just interested in sort of understanding the consequences of treating the gravitational field classically. So I guess the general idea, like the big picture that we have, is that we're going to take the gravitational field to be classical, and then we're going to write down some sort of general master equation, which couples classical and quantum dynamics, and then use things like symmetry, complete positivity, and various physical input to determine some of the theoretical and experimental consequences of treating the gravitational field classically. And I want to emphasize this is not the same as semi-classical gravity. So it's not the same as what we're not doing is having a gravitational field sourced by some expectation value of a quantum stress energy tensor in a very non-linear way. Instead, we have a master equation, which is linear in the density matrix. And then we couple the classical and quantum degree of freedom in that way. And in this talk, I won't talk much about imposing various symmetries, et cetera, but instead, because it's a quantum foundation talk, I want to talk about some of the consequences of complete positivity on the dynamics and what this means for what we can conclude from this about various gravitational, about gravitational physics. So for most of the talk, actually, I'm just going to talk about coupling classical quantum systems in general. And then right at the end, we're going to see how we can use this to learn some lessons. And essentially, most of the things we prove in the papers come from considering complete positivity of dynamics and using clever inequalities, to derive some interesting consequences. So in particular, I'm going to talk about a trade-off between decoherence and diffusion that we can prove has to happen if you consider a coupling between classical and quantum dynamics. So essentially, the idea is that when you have a classical system interacting with a quantum system, because the interaction has to be stochastic, you can show as a necessary condition for complete positivity that you have to have a decoherence term. So the interaction of the quantum system with the classical system necessarily induces some sort of decoherence on the quantum system. And similarly, you can show that when you look at the classical degrees of freedom, the back reaction of the quantum system on the classical system necessarily results in some diffusion of the classical degrees of freedom. And there's this trade-off between the two. So, you know, it turns out that long coherence times require strong diffusion. And as a consequence, we're going to see that because essentially you can get upper bounds on the coherence times from experiment, we'll see how that when we apply this theory to a toy model of quantum field interacting with a Newtonian potential, we'll end up with a lower bound on the amount of diffusion that we see. And this potentially provides an indirect test for the quantum nature of gravity. So essentially, if you treat the gravitational field as being classical, we predict as a prediction of this, you expect to see some amount of diffusion in the gravitational field. And then you can imagine proposing an experiment. And if you don't see this diffusion, then you know gravity cannot be treated classically.
Zach, do you take questions during the talk, or you prefer at the end?
I go for the question, I think. Questions during the talk, yeah.
Some of these ideas are new for me. Just very simple. The physics you're thinking here, just tell me just if I'm right or wrong. If you quantum split a particle, a mass, and you have a mass in between, you have half probability that is attracted by one, half probability is attracted by the other. So it's just half the time to go up and half the time go back probabilistically. Is that the physics you have in mind?
So you have a mass and you're imagining putting the mass through like a beam splitter or something like this?
Yeah. So I have a mass and I put it in a superposition of two positions.
Yes.
And in between there is another mass, classical.
Okay.
And classical. It's just the gravitational field of the other. So you're saying that now stochastically half of the time goes up, half of the time goes back. Is that the physics you have in mind?
Not quite. I think you're on the right track, but there's something that I'm going to talk about later on, which is the fact that when you ask for the state to be complete, when you ask for the state to be positive, you get this natural suppression of coherence. So I'll talk about this later on. So maybe I'll answer your question if that's okay in about two slides of time.
Sure, sure.
Otherwise, I guess, yeah. Hopefully, but if it's not clear, please interrupt and let me know and we can discuss.
Okay, thanks.
Relating to what Carla was talking about, we'll also see that when you, by demanding positivity of this classical quantum state, you end up getting something, you can end up showing that there's a bound on the amount of coherence you can prepare. And this gives some insight into some of the natures of the DOC Penrose decoherence rate. So this relates to the question that Carlo asked, and hopefully I'll explain what we mean by this in a minute. So first of all, I want to discuss just what is a classical quantum state. And for those of you not familiar, I may use language that's very unfamiliar because we've got a lot of different fields and sort of put them together. So if anything I make doesn't make sense, please let me know and I'll try and explain. So the idea is that we're going to take the classical degrees of freedom to live in a phase space, and generically I'll denote them by Z or Q and P or G and Pi or various other symbols. And the idea is that the state space is you have for each possible classical degree of freedom, say Q and P, a subnormalized density operator, which is positive and normalized in total. So that when you integrate over all the classical degrees of freedom and take the trace over the quantum system, you end up with one. And this basically tells you those conditions on positivity and normalization ensure that probabilities are all greater than zero and all add to one. So as a simple example, you can consider a hybrid qubit with classical position and momenta, Q and P. And then for each possible position and momenta, you have a two-level qubit system, which must be positive and trace greater than one. and normalized, sorry. And you can immediately see some interesting conditions from positivity. So the fact that the hybrid qubit has to be positive, essentially as a necessary condition, it means that the determinant of this 2x2 matrix has to be positive. And this immediately gives you a bound for the amount of coherence that you can have. So the off-diagonal term alpha is bounded by the product of the populations U0 and U1. And what this means is that for coherence, the classical distributions U0 and U1 describing the populations must have some overlap. And so I think we'll go into this in a bit more detail later on, but essentially I think with the situation Carlo was mentioning, what happens is that if you try and prepare a superposition of two very different gravitational fields, you have this suppression of the coherence. So in other words, you simply can't prepare a superposition, a coherent superposition of two very different gravitational fields, because the product of their populations will not have any overlap. And so you see that you won't be able to get this alpha to be positive.
So quick question. I'm surprised you seem to be getting this without any dynamical considerations, purely sort of kinematical. Why is that?
Right. So this is one of the things that we found very interesting, is that we get this without any dynamics. So I guess what you end up having is two effects. So you can imagine starting in a state like some sort of delta function in the classical degrees of freedom, and then letting this evolve in time. And in that sense, you'd see that this has to be enforced dynamically. But this is also just something that comes out, because you have to have, in that sense, I guess you see that this condition, if you try and do this experimentally, so you say, okay, I'm in this classical degree of freedom, I then set up my experiment, like I have a classical mass at position zero, I put it through a beam splitter or something like this. This is something that has to happen dynamically, and will be enforced by the fact that dynamics has to be completely positive. But you can kind of cheat in some sense and just imagine that, you know, what I have at the moment is some probability distribution over populations. But I guess in the real scenario, this is somewhat confusing, because you can always measure the classical degree of freedom and you know that there's not going to be a positive, you know that you don't really have a probability distribution over classical degrees of freedom, because you could just measure it. So in some sense, this is some positivity condition that should be enforced dynamically, but you can see a lot of interesting consequences by just looking at the fact that it has to be positive. I'm not sure if that answers the question.
Can maybe this, Lucien, question is oriented. Can this result, Zach, be seen just as a reverse of the theorems that say that a classical dynamic interaction is not possible? In a sense, if you fix the dynamics and the sort of the unitary quantum dynamics, and then you take it fixed, then you say, okay, I get in contradiction because I get negative probabilities in a sense.
And yeah, here, so that's saying, actually my next slide.
Oh, sorry.
Oh, no, yeah, that's, no, it's okay. But that's, you said it for me, which is perfect.
Okay, sorry.
Before you move on to the next slide, could I also ask a question? So I'm missing one of the assumptions here. Like, what, given how you define things as sort of a Cartesian product between the phase space and the space of density operators, what would prevent having, say, the Z spin up state of your qubit on some region of the phase space and Z spin down orthogonal on the rest of the phase space, in which case these two distributions would not overlap at all? So what's the assumption that prevents that?
Right, so this is for each QP. So you can, I think, if you imagine taking two, so equation two, this is for each Q and P. So I guess if you imagine like you have one set, so imagine you have spin up on one part of the phase space, but spin down on the other parts of the phase space, then here you'll just have, so when you look at the separate regions in phase space, I guess you'll have just one that has a U0 and then a zero everywhere else. And then the other one will have just a zero, right, zero, and then just a U1. Does that answer the...
So it's, I guess what disqualifies my example is that you're demanding that there's coherence between these two eigenstates. If the only two quantum states that appeared were the Z up and the Z down, then at every point in phase space, you know, these two profiles would be like one is non-zero, the other zero, or vice versa, and they would not overlap.
Yeah, I think so. So then they wouldn't have, but then they wouldn't have any coherence between the two because at each phase space, the alpha would be zero.
But I could always like, I mean, it's sort of basis dependent whether I have coherence or not. So you know, I use the example of Z-spin, but there's an infinite number of such examples. You know, I could choose any two orthogonal states.
Yeah.
And you know, all of those would fail to overlap, even though, you know, at least one of them will have coherence in every, in some basis.
Right. So, but I guess in that sense, so you'd have to do like a pointwise change of basis. So you change the basis for each PQ. So for each PQ, you have like a 1, 0, 0, 0 or something like that. And then you change the basis pointwise for each PQ, but this would still mean that, you know, the coherence for each PQ is, I guess that still satisfies this.
So maybe the key assumption here is that you're imagining that as you move through the phase space, the basis, you know, in which the quantum state is diagonal is changing in some non-trivial way.
Like that's
going to ensure that you have this overlap property.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks. Okay. So. So to go on what Carlos said, this is like the opposite. So we can ask the sort of converse question, which is, can we have sort of why do we not see, why do we see interference patterns when we imagine the two-slit experiment with charged particles? So you can imagine the standard two-slit experiment where we send a charge through the left slit or the right slit, and if you send it through the left slit, it has electromagnetic field EL, and if you send it through the right, it has electromagnetic field ER. And you can ask, well, how come it is that we see interference patterns even though, you know, the charged particles are producing electromagnetic fields? So one thing you can do is take the trace over the electromagnetic degrees of freedom and look at the positional degrees of freedom, and you see that the coherence is essentially the inner product between the left and right electromagnetic fields. And so we see coherence precisely because the electromagnetic fields are not orthogonal. And so in the classical case, you know, the states EL, ER are perfectly distinguishable. And this is true so long as they're not probability distribution. So this is essentially the no-go, you know, this is essentially the no-go theorem of Feynman, which says that if you have a deterministic coupling between the classical and quantum degrees of freedom, then you can't have you can't have a consistent coupling because the EL and ER are perfectly distinguishable, and this means you can't have coherence. But if you have a stochastic coupling between the classical and quantum degrees of freedom, then you're dealing with probability distributions, and these can have some overlap. And then you're allowed to have a non-zero coherence so long as the probability distributions for the populations overlap. Is that clear to everyone, or is there any questions? Okay. So I'll talk more about this in a slightly different context when we look at the Diocie-Penrose formula. So we'll go over this again, I guess, later on. So now I want to talk a little bit about classical quantum dynamics. So we've talked about the state, and the state has to be positive. So, you know, what type of dynamics are allowed? So essentially, we ask that it must preserve the state space. So, you know, we have a classical quantum state, which, you know, has some classical degrees of freedom, some quantum degrees of freedom. It has to be positive and normalized. And we want the dynamics to preserve the positivity and normalization of the states and the classical quantum split. And you can show essentially that once you ask this, so you ask for the most general, linear, completely positive normalization preserving map that takes classical quantum states to classical quantum states, and you end up with like a CQ version of Krauss's theorem. So this is shown in Jonathan's 2018 paper. And you get, you know, similarly some normalization conditions, and the complete positivity of the map is ensured by positivity of the matrix lambda mu nu. And for those of you that are not familiar with classical quantum dynamics, it's perhaps useful to compare this to the, you know, quantum dynamics and classical dynamics. So in quantum dynamics, you can ask a similar question and you end up with, you know, the Krauss's theorem. In classical dynamics, you have this the standard probability transition equation. And you see very naturally that classical quantum dynamics is a natural generalization of the two dynamics. So one way of thinking about the CQ dynamics is you can imagine fixing, say, Z and Z prime. So you imagine you have at some Z prime, you have a quantum state, rho of Z prime, and you want to know, you know, and at some other and at a later time, you want to consider some other state at rho z, and you know the map between the state at rho z prime to the state at rho z has to be just a completely positive quantum map, but it won't necessarily preserve probabilities because we only ask that probabilities are conserved once you integrate over the whole of phase space. And so then you see that you naturally get this type of classical quantum dynamics. And in fact, most of the time, for the rest of the talk, I'll be talking about classical quantum dynamics on the level of master equations. So just as in the quantum case where you get the Krauss's theorem and you make a Markovian assumption and you arrive at the Lindblad equation, you can do the same thing in the classical case and you end up with the standard rate equation. And in the classical quantum case, again, you end up with a master equation which looks like a very natural generalization of the two master equations. And again, I won't talk much explicitly about the positivity conditions that arise, but it's just very useful to note that, you know, there are positivity conditions which ensure that the map takes positive operators to positive operators. And this is what we use to prove the results I'll talk about later on, but I won't go into the technical details because it's a bit messy and will take away from the message of the talk. So very briefly, I want to talk about a slightly different way of writing the master equation. And I'll talk about this just on the classical level, and then we'll go through and look at the classical quantum dynamics in sort of analogy. So something you can do in the in just classical rate equations is you can perform what's called a Kramer's Mial expansion. And essentially, you just write the rate equation in terms of the moments of the transition amplitude. So this is actually something that people are familiar with. And essentially, so one example is if you take the rate equation and you specify a master equation which only has first moments, and if you take the first moment to be given by related to this some Hamiltonian, you end up with just pure Hamiltonian evolution. And I guess the details of this aren't important, but the important thing to note is that the D1 coefficient, the first moment, characterizes the sort of Hamiltonian evolution in the system, or more precisely, the drift of the system. So I guess the picture to imagine is we have some probability distribution in phase space. So I guess it's useful, as always, to picture a Gaussian distribution in phase space. And the first moment in this Kramer's Mial expansion is just expressing how this Gaussian is moving through time. So you can imagine, like in the case of Hamiltonian evolution, you have a Gaussian. It doesn't spread in time, but the peak of the Gaussian is sort of moving according to Hamiltonian evolution. So another example is if you take a first moment just to be mu and a second moment to be given by D, you end up with the famous Fokker-Planck equation. And this is just to say that the second moment is the thing that's characterizing the amount of diffusion you have in the classical system. So with the Gaussian example, we have this Gaussian. The first moment's describing how the center of the Gaussian is moving. And the second moment, D2, is describing how the Gaussian is spreading through time. So this is just the well-known stuff from just classical rate equations, but we can do exactly the same thing in the case of classical quantum dynamics. It's just a bit more scary looking. But essentially, we can isolate each of the lines, and I'll tell you what is and what isn't important for the rest of the talk. So for the first line here is exactly the same moment expansion as in purely classical dynamics, and this is describing the purely classical part of the classical quantum dynamics. The second line here should be familiar to those of you that have studied Lindblad equations, and it's just the pure quantum part of the evolution. And in particular, the important thing to note is that D0 characterizes the Lindbladian coupling. So the zeroth moment D0 is somewhat characterizes the decoherence that the classical system induces onto the quantum system. And the third line is sort of where all the non-trivial evolution is happening, where changes in the classical state correspond to changes in the quantum state. And for most of the talk, we can ignore all the higher order moments that appear here. And we're just going to look at the first moment, the second. Yeah, so the... Sorry.
Okay. No, you were commenting on the third line in the blue box.
Ah, okay. So the third line is what characterizes all of the non-trivial evolution, where you have changes in the quantum state and corresponding changes in the classical state. And the important thing to remember is not all these scary higher order moments, but we're just going to use the zeroth moment, which, as we see, characterizes the decoherence in the system. The first moment, which, as we discussed before, characterizes the Hamiltonian part of the system. So in particular, you know, the quantum system induces some back reaction on the classical system. And when we look at the classical system, we're going to have some probability distribution that's moving through phase space. And the D1 is characterizing how this is moving through the phase space. And similarly, we're going to have quantum system back reacting on the classical system, and the D2 coefficient characterizes how the probability distribution in the classical phase space is spreading with time. And so basically in the paper, we use conditions on positivity to prove a bunch of interesting things. So first of all, we get this CQ-Pavula theorem, which I won't talk too much about. But essentially, it tells us that there's two types of master equations. You either have a master equation which, when you look at the classical degrees of freedom, you have some finite probability of having a finite size jump. So you have these jumping equations. So the picture there is that you have some, the classical system and the quantum system are interacting. And when the quantum system and the classical, when the quantum system back reacts on the classical system, you see these finite size jumps. And we can prove that you're either jumping or there's a unique continuous master equation where changes in the, when you get the back reaction of the quantum system and the classical system, you get these trajectories in phase space, which are almost surely continuous, but they're still spreading in time and you still have diffusion. So we also managed to prove that in order to have non-trivial classical quantum interaction, you have to have a decoherence term. So the interaction of a classical system with a quantum system necessarily causes the quantum system to decohere, and you get some collapse of the wave function. Similarly, we show that you have to have a diffusion term. So the interaction with a classical system and a quantum system necessarily results in a loss of predictability on the classical phase space. So a back reaction of the quantum system on the classical system means that you don't know with certainty where what's happening on the classical phase space. And we show that there's a trade-off between the amount of decoherence you have and the amount of diffusion you have. And this turns out to be important experimentally. So the sort of rough idea, which I'll talk about in more detail, is that you end up with a lower bound in terms of the amount of diffusion you must see in the classical degrees of freedom, and in particular in some sort of gravitational degrees of freedom when we study a theory of gravity. And we can use the fact that you have experimental upper bounds on the decoherence rate to get some experimental lower bounds on the amount of diffusion you see. And then we see for a toy model that this actually seems like quite a lot of diffusion. And then, you know, hopefully in the future, we can propose some sort of experiment to test whether or not you see this. So the CQ-Pavula theorem, most of this is not very important, but what is important is that as a corollary, you can see that we must have a decoherence term and you must have a diffusion term. So I won't talk about the CQ-Pavula theorem, but it's important that we must have a diffusion term and we must have a decoherence term. So we can basically show using the fact that the dynamics has to be completely positive, that there's a trade-off between the amount of decoherence you have and the amount of diffusion you have, which depends on the drift of the system. And essentially, you know, in all cases, so you have different sources of diffusion. So you could, first of all, imagine having purely classical diffusion. So you just have where there's no back reaction of the quantum system on the classical system. Or you can imagine there's diffusion, which is caused by the quantum system back reacting on the classical system. And in both cases, you can show that you have this trade-off. And generically, the trade-off gives you a lower bound in terms of the amount of diffusion you have. in terms of the drift in the system, and in terms of the inverse of the decoherence of the Limbladian coupling D0. And this is what we'll use later on to see that, you know, there's some perhaps important experimental observational consequences of this. So the important fact is that we sort of know what D1 should be, what the first moment should be. So this is what Jonathan talks about in his paper. So Jonathan's paper essentially discusses classical quantum dynamics, and it discusses how you can write down generic classes of classical quantum dynamics which approximately reproduce Hamiltonian dynamics. So I guess the example here, or the way to think about this, I guess, is that we have some quantum system back reacting on the classical system, and we know, so for example, in the gravitational case, what we have is a quantum system interacting with the gravitational field. When we trace out the quantum degrees of freedom and look at the gravitational degrees of freedom, we know from, say, Einstein's theory of gravity, what we expect to see in the classical limit. So we expect to see some, in that case, some dynamics on the classical degree of freedom, which is generated by some ADM Hamiltonian-like interaction. And essentially, this specifies for you what the first moment should be. And once you have this, once you have what the first moment should be, so use this physical input, you can find this, you have a, I'll go back a slide. Once you know what D0, D1 should be, you get a lower bound for the amount of diffusion you have in terms of the decoherence rate. And you can use this to, you know, we'll go through this later on in a simple toy model to find out how much diffusion you would get if you treat the gravitational field classically. So this is like a definite prediction of treating the gravitational field classically. If you treat the gravitational field classically, you predict a certain amount of diffusion, and then you can go and test whether or not you see this diffusion. So perhaps this is a good place to stop to see if there's any questions or if anything's unclear at this point. Okay.
So actually I have a question. So yeah. I didn't really understand your exact definition of classicality.
Okay, yeah, so I don't think, I think I haven't given a precise definition of classicality, but I guess what we're imagining is that you have degrees of freedom living in some phase space, and so they're just going to be some phase space functions like Q and P, or later on we'll talk about the gravitational field or its conjugate momenta, and I think that's as far as we go in discussing what we mean by classical, but hopefully that's, is that clear?
So can a classical field mediate entanglement between two systems?
No, I don't think so, yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about this with regards to your paper actually. So, yeah. Okay, so in order to study the trade-off in a more, concrete setting, we'll look at a toy model of a non-relativistic quantum field interacting with a classical Newtonian potential. So I'll get this master equation and I'll go through it. I won't actually give a brief tour of post-quantum gravity because I think it will take too long and distract from the message, but I'll give a brief summary of some of the ideas. So the main idea is to, you know, to take the classical degrees of freedom to be the gravitational field. So because the language of classical quantum dynamics is that of master equations, we do this in a ADM-type formalism. So we consider the classical degrees of freedom to be a Riemannian three-metric GAB and the conjugate momenta, so that the classical quantum state, essentially for every possible configuration of Riemannian three-metrics GAB and momenta pi AB, you have some quantum state. And then we consider dynamics to be generated by this general classical quantum dynamics in an ADM type formalism. So because it's in an ADM type formalism, you know, there's a bunch of interesting questions that we can ask. So, you know, can the dynamics be independent of the choice of lapse and shift? What does it mean for the theory to be diffeomorphism invariant? All of these very interesting questions. And we study this elsewhere in a paper with Jonathan. And essentially, you know, I think it's very interesting because regardless of whether or not gravity is fundamentally classical, just because you have some interesting conceptual questions you know, which you might have also have in a theory of quantum gravity, but the calculations are a lot easier. So instead of dealing with things like superpositions of gravitational fields, you end up dealing with probability distributions over gravitational fields. And this is just conceptually a lot easier to deal with. But I won't talk too much about this. Instead, we're going to consider a much simpler toy model. So we're going to consider the case where the quantum degrees of freedom is going to be in some partially decohered superposition of left and right states. And we're going to take the classical degree of freedom to be the Newtonian potential phi and its canonical conjugate. So in this case, the state space is very simple. It's exactly the same as the hybrid qubit. You have for each possible configuration of phi and pi, some two-level quantum system. And this is just describing, the possible configurations of a mass and a superposition of left and right states. And so in particular, like what the populations are describing is like, if you imagine you had a mass and superposition of left and superposition of right, then if you measure the gravitational field to be in left, you know that the Newtonian potential phi and pi have some probability distribution UL. And similarly, if you measure the particle to be on the right, you have everything described by a probability distribution UR. So I'm going to talk about how we can use this state in fact, just the state space and the positivity conditions which I discussed earlier. So essentially, because the state space is this two-dimensional matrix, we know that the determinant of the matrix has to be positive, and this gives you some bound on the amount of coherence that you can have. And we're going to use this to perhaps gain some insight into some of the puzzling natures of the DOC Penrose decoherence rate. And we're going to see that this arises for us in a completely different way. So for those of you that are not familiar, the DOC Penrose decoherence rate is this very famous decoherence rate, which describes the decoherence of quantum particles due to interaction with the gravitational field. And so it has some features that certainly we find puzzling. So for example, it's very, very non-local. So you have this 1 over x minus x prime factor here. So it looks a lot like the mass on the left is interacting with the mass on the right at some very, arbitrarily far distances, although it is suppressed by the distance. And the puzzling thing about this is meant to be a dynamical decoherence rate, which arises because, of some fundamental interaction between things. And this seems to be, something that the non-locality seems to be something that's very weird. I should also mention, although I'm not too familiar with the paper, this seems to have also recently been experimentally ruled out as a decoherence rate, at least for some parameter-free versions of DOC's original model. But I think I won't say any more about that. And essentially, we arrive at the DOC Penrose decoherence. We know that the interaction between the classical and quantum degrees of freedom necessarily induces decoherence in this dynamical way due to the D0 moment in the master equation. But we also have this effect due to the fact that the state has to be positive, which gives you a suppression of the amount of coherence which you're allowed to prepare. And so this is the effect that I want to talk about for now. And we'll see that you end up with a bound on coherence that has a lot of similar features to the DOC Penrose decoherence. But this is a suppression of coherence, which is talking about the possible states you're allowed to prepare at some time t equals 0. So the case I'm going to consider is if you have you take the classical quantum state, which I just defined on the previous slide. So you consider a mass in superposition of left and a mass on the superposition of right. And you consider the case that if you measure the mass to be on the left, you have a probability distribution such that the Newtonian potential is sort of Gaussianly peaked around some value phi L. And if you measure the mass to be on the right, then the Newtonian potential should be peaked around some value phi R. And we're going to take the phi L and phi R to be the Newtonian potentials which satisfy Poisson's equation. So this mathematically, what we're saying is that the marginal distributions for the population should be Gaussianly, we're going to take them to be Gaussianly peaked around the Newtonian potentials phi L and phi R, which satisfy Poisson's equation. So in particular, we can imagine phi L is the solution of the Newtonian potential, which satisfies Poisson's equation when the mass is at the position, the left position, and similarly for phi r. And this is a functional Gaussian. So this is like a Gaussian on the space of possible configurations for the Newtonian potential. And essentially, what we can do is we can just go through, we have this 2x2 matrix and we know what the populations are describing. And we can just check that, you know, the determinant of the matrix has to be positive. And this gives us a bound on the amount of coherence you're allowed to have. And this bound in particular, we find a suppression of the coherence, which goes like phi L minus phi R squared. And if phi L and phi R satisfy Poisson's equation, this is exactly the same functional form as the Diocie-Penrose formula. But we arrive at this in a very different context. So what this is saying is, you know, you're actually not allowed to put you can't put two very different masses with very different gravitational fields in a coherent superposition in the first place. So what we're not saying here is that this is not a dynamical decoherence rate where you have some mass on the left interacting with a mass on the right at very non-local scales. Instead, this is just a bound on the possible states that you can prepare. And in particular, it's saying that you can't prepare states with very different gravitational fields and still have coherence. So what I should add is that, first of all, the fact that it's a bound on the coherence of state preparation means that it's a lot less puzzling that you end up with this bound being non-local or non-linear, because it's a condition on state preparation and it's not a dynamical bound. Although I think as Lucien said before, it was...
I'm confused here. In the standard way of thinking, you don't prepare this state. You just evolution drives you there. So you have to. It's not just you say nothing about the equation of motion. You're having very strong constraint on the equation of motion that you don't know.
Yeah. So this is related to the fact that so we have two effects essentially. One is a something to do with state preparation. And I think I agree with everything you say. Usually you don't, you know, this is not usually important, but we also have this dynamical contribution to the decoherence because the classical system must induce decoherence on the quantum system. But we find this is a local decoherence rate if you pick a local master equation. And so we kind of, I agree with you, but we kind of cheating. But so we know because the dynamics is completely positive that this dynamical contribution must enforce the non-dynamical contribution. So we could imagine starting off, you know, with a single mass, as you were describing, putting it through some beam splitter, and what we end up with is the state that we were describing at the beginning. And we don't know, this is something we need to study further, like how does this dynamical contribution enforce this? But we know just because the map has to be completely positive that it ends up having to enforce this. Are there any other questions? This is probably a good place to pause for questions here, if anyone else has any questions.
So in your previous, or thinking here as well, in your version of the Ostiosi, the one before. So it does H bar come into this anywhere, do you have anything to say on the scale, about the scale of this effect?
Right, so I guess, so we don't have so they have to have a H bar, I guess, because they're interested in rates. We instead have this sigma. So essentially our dimensions are determined by the sort of how wide you pick your distributions in the original, if I go back. So you take these marginal distributions and you have to pick a sigma. So you can imagine like the two extreme cases when you take the variance of the distributions to be either very big or very small. And this is okay. Going to depend. So if you take it to be very big, then, you know, even though you have two very different phi L and phi R, because the variance is huge, it really doesn't make any difference. And this becomes a very small effect. Whereas if the variance is really small, then this becomes an enormous effect and you simply can't prepare the superposition. So, okay. Yeah.
Great, thanks.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Sorry, maybe you want to answer this at the end because it's not about this specifically. So it's just about the general model where you have the kind of classical and quantum degrees of freedom, which have to be, you know, positive and, you know, normalized to one, but you can kind of trade probability between them. So, you know, like if you just look at the classical and quantum, they're subnormalized.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you considered, for instance, allowing probabilities to go negative on the classical part, for instance, or kind of generalizing more whilst keeping the general condition. Would this be?
Right. So we haven't thought about this, like, not directly, but we have thought about, like, so one of the things we're thinking about is how we can arrive at this, like, classical quantum dynamics as an effective theory. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that we looked at doing this is taking, like, the Wigner formulation.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I don't know if this is, yes. So, yeah, so we haven't, and we have thought about this, but I don't think I have anything interesting to say. Essentially, what you get when you consider that is we want to sort of take the limit where we can eliminate all the negative probabilities. But yeah, I guess I don't have anything particularly interesting to say there.
Okay, and maybe one comment which might be repeating Carlo's, but just to make sure I understand. So mm-hmm. when you're making arguments, you know, you kind of appeal to the, oh, it must be positive, the density matrix. In a sense, you're just arguing for, like, consistency. And so you're not really giving an argument in terms of, like, some underlying mechanism to explain why you see this effect. You say, because I know the theory is consistent, this must be the case, but you don't provide some kind of mechanism. So you're still...
Yeah. Okay. So what we really need to understand, which is something that we're doing but we haven't done, is to understand sort of how the dynamical decoherence would... So you can imagine starting in a state that is sensible, and then you can try and ask, how does this dynamical decoherence sort of impose this type of bound that we get on the coherence? If that makes sense.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, that's good.
Okay. So that was just talking about positivity of the state. So now I'm going to go back to the trade-off and talk about positivity of the dynamics. So in particular, we have this trade-off between diffusion and decoherence, and the goal here is to use a simple toy model of this quantum field interacting with Newtonian potential to try and get an order of magnitude estimate for how much diffusion and how much energy production you get in the system because of this trade-off. So I emphasize that this is like a order of magnitude estimation, and from a toy model that, and we still don't know exactly how general our considerations are here. So the theory is motivated by considering just linear scalar perturbations of Einstein's gravity. So what we can imagine is that you take the sort of Einstein-Hilbert action, you consider linear perturbations, scalar perturbations of the metric, and you can write down the Hamiltonian, the pure gravity Hamiltonian, which describes how the gravitational degrees of freedom evolve in the phase space, the pure classical evolution of the gravitational degrees of freedom. Similarly, we take the quantum Hamiltonian, the pure quantum evolution, to be generated by essentially the mass operator. So I defined phi, psi, dagger, psi earlier, but essentially psi, psi, dagger is like the, so m, psi, psi, dagger is the mass density operator. So H0m, which is the pure quantum, or part of the pure quantum evolution, is just the mass operator, and HI is this interaction. So we have an interaction between the Newtonian potential phi and the quantum degrees of freedom in a term that goes like phi, the Newtonian potential times the mass density. And then using the theory of Jonathan in this regime, we consider just the general master equation, which is completely positive. And we leave this quite... we leave a lot of the parameters sort of untouched. So we don't specify what D0 is or what D2 is or what any of the higher order moments are. We just consider a master equation that is of this form. And the important sort of physical input that we use here is that we know what the first moment should be. And essentially, if you imagine taking this master equation, we can integrate out the quantum degrees of freedom to look at the classical degrees of freedom alone. And you see the Newtonian potential undergoing some evolution. And we want this evolution to look like, you know, because of the drift term, we want this evolution to look like it's being sourced by a mass so that it reproduces the Newtonian interaction. We also hear we don't diffuse in the Newtonian potential directly, but we could also include this. The reason we don't do this is because we're interested in getting a lower bound for the amount of diffusion that you have to see. are there any questions about this? Because I realize this might be very foreign to people. the important aspect here, I guess, is that we'll end up seeing some diffusion, and on the next slide, I'll put a number to it. But if there is any questions now, this might be a good time. Okay, so essentially, the fact that we have this drift and we know what it means, we know what it should be, leads to a lower bound for the diffusion in the momentum conjugate to phi. And what this does is this results in some amount of gravitational kinetic energy production. so the formula we find here goes like the mass density squared divided by lambda, where this is the decoherence rate. And essentially, we can get an order of magnitude estimate for the amount of gravitational kinetic energy production from this experiment, Gerlich. And what they do is they consider some clever interferometry techniques, which I do not understand at all. And they use this to find the decoherence rate. They get an upper bound for the decoherence rate lambda. And they do this by considering clusters of nucleons of typical mass 10 to the minus 24 kilograms and typical radius 10 to the minus 9 meters. And plugging these numbers into the amount of to the trade-off we get, we find that over the period of the experiment, you expect to see a gravitational kinetic energy production around 10 to the minus 11 joules. And we can compare this to the rest energy of the nucleons, which turns out to be around 10 to the minus 8 joules. And so you see this is sort of a very relevant prediction of treating the gravitational field classically, is that you expect, whenever you treat the gravitational field classically, to see some amount of diffusion in the gravitational field. This leads to some energy production. And if we assume that this energy production, you know, eventually some of it's going to get transferred back to the particles, this seems like a very relevant effect, both on the level of tabletop experiments and perhaps more importantly on the cosmological scale. So essentially, we do this for a very simple toy model of a sort of a linearized model where we consider just the scalar perturbations. And so we don't fully understand some of the consequences of this, like when would the model be valid? More generally, like how strong can our statements be about treating the gravitational field classically? But the lesson is definitely general, which is treating the gravitational field classically leads to diffusion, and there are experimental bounds on that. There should be experimental lower bounds on the amount of diffusion you should see if you treat the gravitational field classically. So to summarize everything, we've seen that how by considering positivity of the classical quantum state, you can find upper bounds for the amount of coherence that you must have. And we see that this is split into two effects. So we have this, first of all, a dynamical term, which is due to the actual dynamics of the master equation, and a non-dynamical term, which is due to the fact that the state must be positive. And as people have mentioned, which we haven't studied, this dynamical term, just by consistency, this dynamical term must also somehow enforce the non-dynamical term. But the interesting thing that we find is that the dynamical decoherence, if you pick a local master equation, is local. So you don't have any sort of unusual effects where it looks like a mass on the left and the mass on the right are interacting over very long distances. But instead, you end up with some sort of local decoherence rate. And this, you end up still somehow you know, gaining some intuition into the arguments of DOC Penrose decoherence. And then secondly, we've seen that there's a trade-off between the amount of decoherence and diffusion by considering the complete positivity of the classical quantum dynamics. And for simple toy models of gravity, this is a very non-negligible effect, and it potentially puts classical quantum theories in danger of running afoul experimental observations. So now I'm going to briefly talk about what we'd like to do next. So first of all, we'd like to better understand the regime of validity for the toy model and the master equation we use, so that we can begin strengthening statements and perhaps propose some experiment. So to emphasize, this trade-off is generic. So whenever you treat some degrees of freedom as classical and some as quantum, you expect to see this some amount of diffusion, and this diffusion has a lower bound, which is related to the drift and the decoherence rate. And so in particular, when you treat the gravitational field as classically, you expect to see some diffusion in the classical, in the gravitational degrees of freedom. And I think that we can use this to propose a potential experiment within you know, the near future technology, where you say, okay, this is the amount of diffusion you should see if you treat the gravitational field as classical, or if the gravitational field is fundamentally classical. And if you don't see this, then the gravitational field cannot be classical. And this leads to a somewhat indirect test of the quantum nature of gravity. Secondly, I think there's a lot of general lessons that can be learned. So a lot of the results, I haven't gone into the technical details here, but they rely just on the fact that the master equation has to be completely positive. And they're largely independent of like the specifics of the dynamics. So a lot of them don't actually depend on the fact that we've made this Markovian assumption. And we might then expect them to generalize to the non-Markovian case, in which case I think you can ask a bunch of very interesting questions. So you can then imagine considering like scattering experiments, for example, where you know at some point T0, the gravitational field behaves classically. You know in the future, it also behaves classically. You really don't care what goes on in between, but you know that the map from the early state to the final state has to be given by some classical quantum map, completely positive classical quantum map. And then if the results that we proved in this paper follow through here, you would expect that you necessarily therefore see some amount of diffusion in the classical degrees of freedom. And then this might lead to some very interesting cosmological consequences, or some, or whenever you're interested in, you know, treating some degrees of freedom as classical, you then expect to see this as a residue effect, and this might prove to be very interesting. And you sort of to go along with that, we really want to understand better when we can use this classical quantum theory to hold as an effective theory. So the picture here is that you could imagine that gravity is a, you know, quantum gravity. And we imagine taking some limit in which the gravitational degrees of freedom behave classically, and we arrive at the classical quantum dynamics. But currently, we don't understand, you know, how to do this particularly well. So something that we're looking at is how you can arrive at this dynamics by considering the classical limit of various quantum systems. So as Tom said, one way we're looking at this is through the Wigner formalism, but there's a bunch of other ways that we're trying to understand how you can arrive at this limit. In which case, I think there's a bunch of very interesting things we can learn quite generally. So thank you very much for listening. And if there's any questions, I see.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's thank our speaker. So I see Carlo raised his hand.
Okay, but first, Zach, thanks a lot, because it was very clear, and it's the first time I understand. I think I understand. I'm not sure I understand. I was always very confused by this research program. Now I see something. So I have maybe it's an objection. So let me present this as an objection. I'm not sure it's an objection. It's just a comment, which is the following. But it's central to what you're doing. You presented these things at the beginning, which was very clarifying for me, as saying, look, you can think of what I'm doing in two different ways. Either that fundamentally there's no quantum interference in geometries, so gravity is really classical. Here's a theory about it. Good. Or alternatively, well, there is quantum gravity. I mean, geometry can be in a superposition, but we know very well. I mean, just we use every day in the lab the fact that there are regimes where you can treat some degrees of freedom classically. This works perfectly well in the lab. That's what we do. Mm-hmm. Here is a formalism well developed for doing that. Good. There is an ambiguity between these two things. Careful, because it's a very different situation. And why is it a different situation? Because the second one is an approximation, obviously. So mm-hmm. It's an approximation because we know in the lab that when we treat the degree of freedom classically, I don't know, the position of the nucleus when we do the hydrogen atom in Schrödinger's first paper on quantum mechanics, we know that this is an approximation. We can go out with this approximation and then that approximation breaks. Now, when you develop your theory, almost everything you've done, I mean, the majority of what is done relies on this beautiful positivity requirement. and from which you deduce a number of things, including even, I mean, this very nice trade-off between diffusion and the coherence and so on and so forth. Right. But this is a consistency requirement which holds if this is within the theory. So if you're viewing this as an approximation, then obviously there is a regime when you go out of this theory, so this positivity is violated, meaning simply that here some quantum effects of what you treated classically come in. So therefore, if you view this somehow, you keep saying, if I treat gravitational field classically, this is the consequence. No, I mean, if you treat gravitational field classically, this is a consequence unless something else happened, which means that I cannot treat it classically anymore. So so all the prediction you give do not hold on the approximation, the second, only come in if you are if you're thinking that there is really a classicality. Now, this is the first point, but this is I expect you agree here, but I let me go to the second point. The second point is an important one. Now, suppose you go the other choice being, all right, I'm really giving a fundamental theory, not an approximation of something else. All your equations are perfectly good as an approximation, obviously. I mean, mm-hmm. you know what you're doing very well, very clearly. But suppose you say, okay, let's take these equations not as an approximation of something else, but as something fundamental. Okay. Now, my objection, here is the objection, is that, I mean, I could formulate it as a terminological thing, but it's not a terminological thing, it's physics. You're not really doing the coupling between a quantum system and a classical system. You are just messing up quantum theory dramatically. You're just doing what Penrose did when he wrote his first paper on that. Namely, he said, quantum theory is wrong. The Schrödinger equation is not linear. There is something else. And the reason I'm saying that is because you hide under the carpet of the dynamics. This was the question by, who asked it, Robert or Lucien? I forgot, about the dynamics. You're saying, well, there should be some dynamics that, you know, keep me in this regime that allows me to do that, to preserve possibility. Fine, you never wrote this down, this dynamics. Now, this dynamics is not a Schrödinger equation, obviously, because a Schrödinger equation is linear, does not allow you to do that at all. Mm-hmm. So what you're saying here, it's either, this is an approximation. So I have no quarrel with any of your formulas, but either it's an approximation, and therefore your prediction are not predictions, or just, you know, this holds within a regime of validity, and then there is interference between quantum gravity, superposition geometries, and then these are not. Or you're saying, look, quantum mechanics is completely false. The Schrödinger equation is violated, which is what Penrose said at the beginning. And I am not just imagining that there is consistency between quantum theory and classical theory. No, not at all. There is an approximation, but there's not fundamentally. Mm-hmm. I have a theory which is not quantum mechanics, is not linear, is not a superposition principle. Nothing of what has been shown to be true generically for 100 years is true, and it's a completely different theory where funny things happen where you don't even have the dynamics. I'm going strong, but
So I guess I'll go in order. So I think I agree generally with the first point. So I certainly would agree that with the point that we don't know how this, if you treat this theory as an effective theory, we don't know exactly how, you know, in what regime this would have validity. So this is why I mentioned at the end that something that would be very interesting is a lot of the results don't seem to rely on the fact you have a master equation, but instead, if you could generalize these to like the non-Markovian case, then I think you would agree that, you know, things are a lot stronger because we're not saying that you have to make a Markovian approximation and the dynamics goes like this, but instead you just consider two regimes in which you know the gravitational field can behave classically, and then you have some approximation. So I definitely agree with you that we haven't pinpointed you sort of exactly when the when this classical quantum dynamics on the level of master equation can be used as an effective theory. But this is something that we're interested in, I guess, because I guess partly you could imagine that, you know, if you imagine you have some distribution that's almost everywhere positive, you're certainly going to almost everywhere have some sort of of trade-off, I could imagine. And so the results, I guess, we expect are generally. With the second point, I guess, I certainly agree with you. It's not coupling in the usual sense between classical and quantum dynamics, because you essentially have information loss, and this is not common to either of them. And so you are definitely you're sort of deviating away from standard quantum theory or standard general relativity. I guess as you say, we haven't written down like a fully we've studied various master equations, including in the gravitational context, but we haven't written down like a all working quantum theory of gravity, which is say diffeomorphism invariant and has all the nice properties that you want to have. But I guess I would argue that you could certainly imagine the scenario where you turn off the interactions when you're in, say, flat space. So if you manage to turn off the coupling when you're in flat space, then the theory, because you just have this pure quantum theory, just reduces to the standard theory of, like, you know, you can imagine it reduces to the standard model, and you only get these couplings turned on in very, or not in very extreme examples, but in more extreme examples where we really haven't tested the validity of quantum mechanics. But I mean, I would say I was agnostic, and I certainly agree that if we want to propose a fundamental theory, there's a variety of things that we have to solve first. So one of these, for example, is like the BPS problem, which I'm not sure if people are familiar with, but the BPS problem essentially was this problem. So I guess when the black hole information, when Hawking did the black hole information calculation, I think it was a paper by Banks, Peskin and Susskind, who looked at whether or not you could have things like Lorentz invariants and have locality and information loss. So they show that, you know, if you want to have a theory that's Lorentz invariant, has information loss, you have to violate locality. Or if you have locality and I guess that there's this trade-off between the three is the important thing. And we'd have some sort of similar problem here. Perhaps, which is a very serious objection. And so I certainly agree with you that there's a long, long way to go before we can propose like a fundamental theory, which is all working.
I understand your question. I understand your answer, and I don't have any objection. Let me shove in just a little bit, and then I'll shut up. Suppose you take classical gravity, no quantum, okay? And for matter, just one particle, and forget the Schwarzschild singularity. I mean, forget those kind of things. The Schrödinger equation for a particle. Forget relativity, everything. What's a correction to the Schrödinger equation?
In this case, I guess so. You would end up
Missing. It's a quantum matter part that I don't see. It's what replaces quantum mechanics.
Okay, so when we write down this master equation, we have like a pure classical evolution term. So maybe I should share my screen?
But if you do it with one qubit and one...
So the effective equation of motion for the density matrix of the qubit will look like just dI rho dt equals like the Hamiltonian acting on rho plus some other correction terms, which will be the terms which introduce the noisy terms. So like we can write down an equation which is dI rho dt equals minus I h rho plus the corrections. And this term, we can always have this. And in that sense, it's not a radical change to quantum mechanics because the higher order corrections are, you could imagine a small. So I can share screen to go to the equation. If I scroll up, sorry.
Do you have it for a particle? Do you have the correction for the actual Schrödinger equation, the original Schrödinger equation for continuous variable?
So in a background gravitational field,
yeah.
No. We haven't done that, but I it's something that I guess that we're thinking about doing. So we just, for this example, we just take like the simplest thing we can do, but I guess generically it might be a little bit harder, but I guess it's something that we're interested in looking at. So I guess,
it's not a small departure for quantum mechanics. I mean, it's just dramatic. It's just, you give up the superposition principle, you give up linearity, you give up the standard way of thinking about the Born rule. It's another theory. It's nothing to do with quantum mechanics.
Right, but so, I mean, so the general CQ expand, the master equation, say, it takes this form here. So you could imagine, if you imagine the following regime, which is that you just have the pure quantum evolution and everything else is really small, then this is not this is very similar. Well, this is going to look exactly like quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics
Of course. I mean, if everything else is very small, but the small thing is just messing up linearity.
I agree with you that, yes, a radical change, there's a lot of things that would be, you know, if we take this as a fundamental theory, it's a radical change from standard quantum mechanics.
Exactly. And if you take it as an approximation, these are not predictions. This is just whenever you go out from the regime of validity of the approximation.
Right. I would say the following. So although I agree with you that there's a lot of difference between, say, this is a fundamental theory, I guess some of the differences are, in fact, quite nice. So you get collapse of the wave function for free, for example, which I think, I mean, although you have this information loss and you might say this is very bad, one of the nice things is that it, as you say, you don't necessarily need the Born rule, which seems like this might be a positive effect that the theory predicts. But I think in general, I agree with you that, you know, this, if this was fundamentally classical, it is a radical departure from both of them. But I still think it's interesting to explore, also for a number of reasons, just because we seem to get a lot of interesting conceptual questions, because we can consider things like, you know, what happens when you treat the gravitational field classically, and you end up dealing with things like probability distributions over metrics, which is just a lot easier to deal with than superpositions. And so there's like a lot of conceptual issues I think you can learn from studying these types of equations, I guess, regardless of whether or not, you know, it's a true expansion, a true, if gravity is fundamentally classical or not. But yeah, I certainly don't have any objections to what you're saying. I agree with what you're saying. I think it's still interesting to study this as a theory, yeah. Partly because I guess everything else is very complicated and we can learn some lessons from this. And, you know, there's a lot of, I guess, conceptual issues in all directions of quantum gravity, so.
Thank you. Thank you, Zach.
Rob?
Yep.
Thanks, Zach. That was a really good talk. I have a bunch of questions, but let me just ask one for now that kind of ties into what Carlo was asking about. So I'm trying to understand the connection to the collapse theories and the approach that, you know, the dynamical mm-hmm. collapse models. And so I'm going to sort of tell a story, and you can sort of correct me and say if you see it differently. So, you know, when you look at the history of people who studied collapse models, and, you know, they were primarily motivated to solve the quantum measurement problem. Mm-hmm. You know, they weren't motivated by quantum gravity. But they take like people like Philip Pearl, GRW, those guys. They started out imagining that maybe the dynamics, you know, was nonlinear in the wave function. And they came up with some theories that had a lot of inelegant features. But then sometime in the 80s, they struck upon some theories that really were quite nice. And I would say in retrospect, you know, we can now say from the quantum information perspective that they were nice because those theories involved, you know, master equations that essentially corresponded to completely positive dynamics. Mm-hmm. So they had found theories that deviated from quantum theory in a way that sort of could be embedded in quantum theory in a natural way, right? It's completely positive dynamics. So, you know, the usual quantum rules apply. One of the consequences of that for me is that it also means that there's a Steinspring dilation theorem, which if I like means that I could say, well, it's not that the dynamics has changed, it's that the kinematics has changed, that there's some other degree of freedom to which you're coupling unitarily and then you're ignoring, right? So mm-hmm. a consequence of all these nice features is that you can always think of it that way.
Yeah.
But typically they didn't consider like many of them thought of sort of classical noise, but they didn't try to make that classical noise dynamical. Mm-hmm. Now they could have done that. They could have said, let's throw in some other degrees of freedom as our kind of noise source, give it dynamics as well. And then the same philosophy would have said, as long as they made the dynamics of that whole thing completely positive, it would sort of fit into the quantum formalism nicely. And it still could be Steinspring dilated to an even bigger system. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me like you've done something that's kind of like that, that you wouldn't have to have made those extra degrees of freedom gravitational. They could have been anything. They could have said, let's just follow the collapse models, but now we're going to model the classical stuff, which is adding the noise to the quantum systems. We're going to model that dynamically. And so I think it goes a little bit beyond collapse theories in that sense, because one thing the collapse theories typically did was assume that that was sort of Markovian, that there was no memory in that noise. Whereas you, in your sort of approach, could say, oh, maybe some information leaks into that classical degree of freedom and then comes back later. So that's something that I think would not arise in a collapse theory. So that's one way in which your theories are going beyond collapse theories, that you could probe those sorts of interactions. But what it does lead me to wonder is whether, like in the collapse models, they were very concerned to make the parameters such that if I do have a single system, like Carlo was describing, you know, in the lab where we know that there's coherence, you want the decoherence to be so extremely small that it's still consistent with all the experiments we've seen, right? So they've chosen the parameters in those class models to say, nothing we've seen experimentally rules these out, because we expect when the system sizes are small, that these decoherence rates will be very low. And so what I'm wondering is, have you kind of done that verification that, you know, once you make your decoherence system, this classical gravitational degree of freedom, do you still see that small scale experiments are expected to be coherent? And so it's consistent with all the things we've seen.
Right. So this is I think the interesting part of the calculation. So as you say, like in the collapse models, one of the things that you can do is you can just imagine that you have this like fine tuning parameter that you just make small enough so that everything agrees with experiment. And essentially what this is in our models is the D0 term. So what we're saying here is that it's borderline. so we take this, so whenever you have this D0 and you tune it to be very small, what this means is that the diffusion you see has to be very big. And so there's this very finely balanced trade-off between the amount of decoherence you have in diffusion. And you can't just take the decoherence term to be arbitrarily small so that it agrees with the experiment, because otherwise you'll see this huge amount of diffusion. And so what we essentially show here is that it's super borderline. So if the experimental observations get much better, or perhaps we consider a slightly different experiment which is more suited to the models, then you expect to be able to see this diffusion experimentally. So I think what this trade-off between diffusion and decoherence says is basically there are no free parameters, because as soon as you tune the decoherence parameter, you blow up the diffusion parameter. And so this, I think the moral of the story is that if gravity is to be fundamentally classical, then this is extremely close to being experimentally testable. I think if that answers your
question. Can I have a short follow-up? So maybe this is something I'm not understanding, that what you just said suggested that you had some sort of tunable parameters in your model. But was I right in thinking that you were also imagining that this, you know, a coupling to the gravitational degree of freedom is the way that quantum systems interact with one another gravitationally? Like if I have two bodies, I was sort of imagining that the gravitational degree of freedom is ultimately in this theory going to explain how they interact gravitationally, which would suggest that you don't have freedom in choosing these parameters, that you have to get them to reproduce what, you know, in the limit that your matter degrees of freedom become classical, it should reproduce our theory of gravity. And so that would seem to me to tie your hands, and you wouldn't have a lot of freedom in choosing those parameters. And so that sense in which I was wondering whether it's consistent with the experiments.
Yeah, so I think I agree with what you just said. So essentially the thing that we know, you know, the physical input that we know is essentially this D1 term. So the D1 term tells us how we expect gravitational fields to interact with quantum systems. And I guess a priori, you don't know what the diffusion terms are going to be doing, because, you know, these effects we expect to be very small, and you have to do some sort of quantum, or some sort of, I was going to say quantum gravity experiment, or some sort of experiment which is very sensitive to the gravitational field. And so the D0 and the D2 term, I guess, we don't have any physical input as to what they should be. So you can imagine, you know, that they are a priori, not given. And you could think that, okay, well, that's great. I have two free parameters. But what we're saying here is that actually, if you make D0 small, then D2 has to be huge. So this is given, so fix D1. So the physical input from gravitational physics is, we know what D1 is. Then we know that there's this trade-off between D0 and D2. And then we use experimental tests from by exactly the same as for the collapse models to find what the smallest possible allowed D0, or what the largest possible allowed D0 is. And this gives us a lower bound that we can test is whether or not this is, if this works with the experiment. And it turns out that this is very, it's going to be very tightly, finely tuned. And I think I would say, I'm not sure if everyone would agree with me in the group, but I would say that I think this, you know, potentially, if we really nail down, you know, the validity of this toy model, when we're talking about whether or not the degrees of freedom can be fundamentally classical, I think you could probably propose an experiment like as it is, where you should be able to see this diffusion. So I think it's, I guess the essence of the story is that, as you say, we can't tune much, and so we can't really tune anything. And it turns out that this is very tightly, it's going to be very tightly bound with the experiment, which I think is very interesting. So this provides, you know, potentially some indirect test of the quantum nature of gravity. So if you treat it fundamentally classically, it has to be completely positive, and you really don't have much choice in the parameters that go in. If that makes sense, that helps.
Yeah. So let me see if I understand it. I'll just summarize that you know, gravitational phenomenology sort of fixes what D1 has to be, mm-hmm. but leaves D0 and D2 relatively free. The absence of the fact that we can see coherence in certain quantum experiments constrains D0, right? So they take the experiment we have on macroscopic superpositions, that's going to constrain D0, but then D0 in turn influences what D2 has to be, which is why you focus on saying we're going to go looking for diffusion, the gravitational diffusion, because that's what D2 is. So that's your,
yes.
You know, now you've used up all the sort of empirical input, and you're left with a prediction about diffusion on the gravitational degrees of freedom.
Yes, yeah, that's okay. Exactly, that's perfect. That's...
Okay, that helps, thank you.
Yeah. And I guess with the first point, we don't have I'm not sure if you mentioned this, or we don't have like a purification of the classical degrees of freedom. I guess this is where things differ from with the collapse models. Like there's no natural purification of the classical quantum system, or that we know of, I guess. Well.
Let's let some other people ask questions. Like we could come back to that later if there's time. But
I guess my first of all, very very nice talk, and I understood the program like Carla said much better this time around. But my complaint is in some ways the sort of opposite one to Carla. I think that this is almost. You know, this is in some ways too conservative. It looks to me just like quantum theory. Sorry, Heather. There's a dog making a lot of noise in the background. in a sense that you know, it's a master equation for the reasons that Rob gave. It looks like it. It's completely positive dynamics. So this is sort of what my understanding of quantum theory is. This is how I conceptualize what quantum theory is. And in some ways it's very different from general relativity in its most conceptually simple form. You know, general relativity is a field theory where you give field equations pertaining to each point, and you can re-express that in canonical terms, where you have, you know, the ATM formalism, where you have where you split space and time up into 3 + 1 and have an evolution equation. But that seems to me to be an unnatural thing to do, but nevertheless, it's often a way people try to bring quantum theory and general relativity together. So I wonder. Two questions. I wonder if you can imagine an approach that doesn't do that, that sort of is more four-dimensional in spirit, rather than 3 + 1. And then I think related to this, you skipped through but didn't really talk about how you dealt with diffeomorphism invariants. But I wonder if you could say just a few more words about that, and maybe a follow up. So another point which relates to this is, you know, if you have, if you add probability to a theory that has, you know, some sort of dynamic or causal structure, then you expect to get situations where you have probabilistic mixtures, which sort of makes up not just don't just mix up things across space, but also you have probabilistic mixtures involving space-time. So you'd have something like a mixture over time like as well as space like sort of causal relation. So if you impose a time evolution on the situation, it seems like you're missing that possibility. I threw a lot of stuff at you, but I wonder if you could just say some things along that direction.
So I guess with we have thought about like other ways to go at things. So for example, in the you can actually so I didn't go into this classical quantum Pavula theorem much, but in this classical quantum Pavula theorem, if you take this continuous master equation, which is not important what it is, but you can write a path integral approach, and then you might hope that you could get something that looks a bit more, I guess, in line with general relativity, where you're looking at summing over metrics or summing over classical metrics or something like this. But we haven't really explored this much. I can say a few words about the ADM formalism. I'll try and, what we sort of the ideas that we had in dealing with what you mentioned. And I guess in general, this is why I think this is very interesting, because I think you can deal with the conceptual issues of like, what do you mean? So in general, I guess we have this 3+1 split, and you have like the gravitational field GAB, the 3 metric and its conjugate. And you then consider like probability distributions over these because we're diffusing in space. So one way, for example, that we talk about diffeomorphism invariants is you can imagine in the 3+1 split, you get each of these trajectories. So I guess the picture is as follows, like in just pure classical dynamics with some probability distributions, you can imagine starting off at some time t0, you evolve forwards and backwards in time to get some trajectory of GAB, πAB. You can then use the lapse and shift to like embed this into a forward geometry, do some diffeomorphism, project back, and then see if you have the same type of equation of motion. And when you do this, I guess one of the things that happens is you end up, I guess, which relates perhaps to your comments about what happens when you have like probabilities of mixtures of causal structures, is that the time is somehow encoded in the lapse and shift vector. So if you imagine starting with some, you just pick some lapse and shift vector, you evolve your dynamical equation of motion to get some probability distribution over these trajectories, so over trajectories of GAB, πAB, NTX, NA. If you then do a diffeomorphism on each of these trajectories, so you embed them into the four space, you do a diffeomorphism, when you project back, you'll get a different lapse and shift for each one of these trajectories. So it's a fact of, I guess, general relativity that when you do the time-like diffeomorphisms and you look at how the lapse changes according to something that depends on the actual 3 metric. So I think Carlo will be very familiar with this. When you look at like the Hamiltonian constraints in general relativity, you end up with something that's an algebraic because the change in lapse actually depends on the metric itself. And so when you do the diffeomorphism and look at how you're changing your lapse or your notion of time, you see that you end up with a lapse which is different for each possible trajectory. So there's really quite a lot of information in how you choose the lapse. So you could imagine choosing a lapse for each possible configuration of G and pi. And in some sense, this is then giving you a time for each one of your trajectories that you have. If that answers, I said a lot. I took your many questions and I raised you many answers.
Yes. So maybe just to push on, on this. I mean, so if you have a probability distribution over space like hypersurfaces, so this is the offender. If you have a probability distribution over space like hypersurfaces, and you evolve that forward in time. I mean, it's not quite what you're doing because you have quantum theory in there as well, but there's something like this. You have a distribution of a quantum and classical variables on a series of space like hypersurfaces. How would you get to a situation where you I mean, how could you conceptualize a situation where what you really should have is a probability distribution that's over space-time? And surely there would be, I mean, although evolving a distribution over space and in time, although that would give you some distributions over space-time, surely it wouldn't give you all of them. Surely there would be distributions over space-time that would be admissible, but not expressible as the evolution of something over space in time.
Right. So the way we get space-time vectors, space-time metrics is, I guess, the same way that you, the same way that you do the same, that you get them in the ADM formalism, I guess. So you have this metric defined on a three surface, you evolve in time, and what you end up with is some trajectory of Riemannian metrics and their conjugate momenta. So you end up with like a GABTX and a PiABTX. And then you use the lapse and shift via the ADM decomposition. So you write the you can sort of define a four metric via the ADM decomposition, which depends on the lapse and shift and your notion of time. And in this sense, you can, from your trajectories on the phase space, you can define a four metric G via this VADM decomposition. And this is somehow describing, I guess, in normal general relativity, how the surface is sigma, like embed into the full space M.
Okay.
And then is that what you were asking, or am I?
So that gives you sort of, that gives you a way to go from a sort of a given deterministic description of a particular solution for G mu nu. But now if you have a probability distribution over distributions that can't be understood as the evolution of a probability distribution. So,
right.
A distribution over space-time that can't be understood necessarily as the evolution of is that something you can deal with? There's been all this work in on indefinite causal structure, sort of trying to looking at things like when you have a superposition of different causal orders, or you could even just consider a classical mixture of different causal orders. But can you sort of, my question is, can you deal with that kind of thing in this framework?
I think so, yes. So I guess we're sort of like one, maybe we're one step abstractly removed from that, because we have the probability distributions over metrics. It's somewhat, I guess, I'm also not familiar with the the work on causal structure, so maybe I'm missing the main the main
point.
Can I try
to sharpen this question?
please do.
The way I understand it. Suppose you have a full solution of your equations, so you have the full probability position. Do you get, for the gravitational part, do you get a probability distribution on the four-dimensional geometries?
Right, so you can get a...
Diffeomorphic?
Yeah, so in the same... Yeah, sorry.
Or not, or you get something more complicated.
So, I guess... So first of all, in the analogy where, like, in the pure, like, if you imagine the pure classical analogy, which would be that you end up with, you imagine picking some initial three metric GAB and PiAB, you evolve in time, perhaps forwards and backwards, and you end up with trajectories which happen each with some probability. So you imagine you have a probability function which, you know, for each possible trajectory gives you some probability of the trajectory. Although that won't technically make sense, but you can imagine that sort of scenario. And because each of these trajectories, you can use the ADM formula, like you can use the, if you have a lapse and shift, you can use this to define a four metric. In that sense, you end up with a probability distribution over four metrics. And so in that sense, you end up being able to talk about.
No. You get under probability distribution of four metrics. But you can have two different four metrics, which are diffeomorphic. Same, and do you get the same number, same probability density for the two?
So this is something that we've been beginning to check. Like, can you have a diffeomorphism invariant theory when you have these probability distributions? So it's something that we've worked on and we're currently working on. But I certainly, yeah, this is where I think things are interesting, because you can ask those sorts of questions and you can come up with definite answers. But I guess one of the interesting things is that, you know, as soon as you embed the geometries into the four geometry, you have to worry about the Gauss-Kadachi constraints. And these are very restricting things. And these seem to perhaps be worrying in when you talk about diffeomorphism invariance in this type of formalism. Does that answer the question?
Okay. Yeah.
Rob, you want to ask something?
Well, I've already had a chance, so let's see if anybody else wants to ask a question. But if there isn't, I can ask one.
Yeah, I think you can go ahead.
So it's about the second point of motivation, where you said, rather than thinking about this as a fundamental theory, we could think of this as a classical limit of a truly quantum theory. So I want to just, I think the easiest way to ask the question I want to ask is, suppose that you had a proposal that was not a gravity proposal, but like I said, so there's a collapse model wherein you have this extra classical degree of freedom. And let's make it really simple. It's a particle in 1D and it's got a phase space. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so I've got this collapse model where my quantum system couples to this particle in 1D. And I say, okay, well, that's classical now. And so I demand that the overall evolution is completely positive, and I get these classical quantum states and so on. Now, the way I do that is by saying that classical system, I can embed that in quantum formalism by saying there's an orthogonal basis for that system, which is labeled by Q and P, right? That, you know, for every different point in phase space corresponds to an orthogonal state in some Hilbert space for that system. And so I just couple those orthogonal states to my truly quantum system. But in a way, that's not the natural, that's not the way a 1D particle goes classical. Like if it's going classical by virtue of decohering with some environment, it will pick out the position basis or maybe the momentum basis, depending on what the interaction with the environment is, but not a basis which is labeled by points in phase space. It's very unnatural for a system to be decohered in a way that it picks out points in phase space. I can imagine something that sort of quasi-decoheres it and picks out, say, coherent states. Mm-hmm. But then it's not strictly a classical system, right? Because those coherent states overlap, they're not orthogonal, the dynamics is very different. So my question is, it seems to me you're making a similar claim that you're sort of, you've got like a classical limit of some quantum theory, and yet you're using sort of an orthogonal basis that's labeled by phase space points. And that seems like a classical limit that we don't normally encounter. So I don't know, is my question clear or not?
Yeah, no, I think it's very, this is something that we're puzzled by at the moment, because we're trying to arrive at this type of theory by considering the classical limit of quantum systems. So I think we have in mind the sort of second picture where, I guess, so one of the things that we've been looking at is you have like we have these Wigner distributions and we imagine you have two quantum systems interacting with each other and one of the quantum systems interacting with a third system, like a heat bath, which causes it to classicalize. And I think sort of the idea, I guess, that we have in mind there is that, I guess, at least mathematically, what happens is you end up with once the system classicalizes, you then end up with some probability density that is everywhere positive, labeled by Q and P, and you then consider the dynamics in this type of formalism. But then, as you say, it's obviously basis independent. If you make some change of basis, then it doesn't make this classical limit just doesn't make sense. But I think we're imagining this sort of I can't remember how you put it, but that type of type of like coherent state.
That's actually very helpful, because it's, I was sort of imagining that as one of the alternatives. So the way I would put it is that, you know, another way to get to a classical limit with say a particle in 1D is just to make sure that there's enough decoherence that its density operator always has a Wigner representation that's positive everywhere. And so that doesn't have, you know, there's lots of different types of decoherence that will get you to that. So, you know, there's many decoherence models, but you need to have the Wigner representation positive everywhere. But But if that's the intention, then it seems to me that maybe there's some constraints missing, because the positive Wigner representations aren't all the probability measures on phase space. They're a very restricted subset. In particular, the area over phase space they span is never less than h bar, and mm-hmm. and so there was nothing in your formalism that constrained that those probability measures on phase space have to be valid Wigner states for a quantum state. You know, like if you were doing it with a 1D particle, it would be clear what that would mean. Some of my own work where I've looked at take a classical theory, add an epistemic restriction, and get out a subset of all the probability distributions on phase space. It formalizes exactly what those constraints have to look like.
Okay, so you're saying that we could make there's even even stronger constraints on the actual classical what this dynamic should have, because we further know some extra information about what rho should look like if it's to make sense in there on both rows. Okay, that's very interesting. Is that
it's kind of like a classical, like
a good reference.
I have a paper called Reconstructing Gaussian Quantum Mechanics Using Liouville Mechanics with an Epistemic Restriction.
And actually, we were thinking about using this in a separate, to understand just like whether or not you can use some of the conceptual problems that we had thought about with like probability distributions over these gravitational fields, if we could use those epistemic restrictions to get some quantum gravity insights, but we haven't done this yet. But that sounds interesting. I think I froze.
Okay, good.
Thank you very much, everyone. That was very great. I really appreciate all the questions and everything.